The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we were looking at some of the unusual or unique characteristics of nematodes. There is one other that I think probably is worth noting. It is a little bit technical, but for those of you that have some background in biology, I think you might find it interesting. It has to do with how energy is obtained by the nematodes. The primary molecule that is the basis of supplying energy to organisms, plant or animal, is ATP, glucose. This is the common monosaccharide in food. Now, the foods are ingested, digestion occurs, and you have glucose that is circulating in the circulatory system, and you have mechanisms then in cells that will take this 6-carbon sugar, glucose, and break it down initially into 2-3-carbon fragments. This is the process of glycolysis. In some organisms, most of the higher organisms, there is a second process known as the Krebs cycle. And this is a cycle in which there are enzymes present that will take the 3-carbon fragments and oxidize them down, if the process goes normally, ultimately to carbon dioxide and water. So you have a first one that is anaerobic, that takes the 6-carbon molecule, breaks it down into the 2-3-carbon fragments. Then you have Krebs cycle that takes the 3-carbon fragments and oxidizes them to carbon dioxide and water. Now, glycolysis, where that cleaving of the bond between the 2 middle carbons occurs, it will produce enough energy to charge 4 ATP molecules. But it requires the energy of 2 ATP molecules to cause the process to occur. So you actually have 2 more ATP molecules after it's over with than you had before you started. On the Krebs cycle, however, for each of the 3-carbon fragments, there is enough energy released to supply 18 ATP molecules, which means that there will be a total of 36 ATP molecules charged for each of the 2 fragments of the 6-carbon glucose molecule. Now, whether you followed all of this or not is really not too important, but the conclusion simply is that there's a great deal more energy that can be provided by the cells if they have the enzymes that are capable of conducting the Krebs cycle. Now, what does all this have to do with the nematodes? Well, interestingly, the adults of many of the parasitic nematodes have an anaerobic energy metabolism only. That means they do not have the Krebs cycle, so that they do not have enzymes that are capable of producing the bulk of the energy that's left in the 3-carbon fragments that came from the original glucose molecule. Now, some of them have Krebs cycle, some of them don't, and so you have a very interesting variation here in organisms within the same class, or certainly the same phylum. If you are interested in genetics, this gets then to the consideration, how did this happen? How did you have within the same group of organisms, some of them, that have the enzyme systems capable of carrying out only glycolysis and therefore have a very low level of percentage of energy released from the glucose molecules, as opposed to those organisms that have the ability to carry out the Krebs cycle? Now, you could argue legitimately that if they are parasitic inside the body of a host, they simply do not have the metabolic requirements that they would have if they were free living and had to do everything for themselves. Now, again, that observation is true, but I really don't think the roundworms were aware of that. They did not go through a process of reasoning which echoed what we have just said, and therefore began to arrange in their own bodies the genetic capability of doing one or the other of these. We simply observe the fact that in different organisms within the same phylum, you have certain of the organisms that have that ability and certain of them that do not have that ability. Now, one of the tempting explanations here for the evolution is just to argue, this just means that parasites then lost the characteristics, basically lost the ability to produce the enzymes to carry out the Krebs cycle. Well, if that were the case, why some and not others? There really is not any external force or entity that has the capability of changing the genetic sequence, the sequence of nucleotides in the genetic material itself. And it just remains one of these little mysteries. And the only point I would make here simply is the fact that this is not, there is no evolutionary basis which would act as a reasonable description of why some of the organisms have this ability and some of them do not, even though they're found within the same phylum or the same classes. And it simply means that in the overall view, the people who are willing simply to grant that the differences, the similarities, are up there as a result of God's creative activity, I think have a more reasonable position than the evolutionist who is trying to draw on a multiplicity of unobservable processes which have been simply the result of the necessity of the evolutionary philosophy to try and provide a basis of understanding the things that we see. At the very least, it has to mean that you have a non-scientific area that is being used as an attempt for providing a scientific description of what's happening. Now, this kind of thing happens regularly with the evolutionists. It is not usually advertised or made plain, but it certainly happens. And my plea simply is that it be plain, it be that both evolutionists and creationists be aware that this kind of thing happens. And often, for those of you that are listening to the program over any period of time, we spent some time earlier discussing at some length the idea of scientism. Scientism, I defined at the time simply as being holding a position which is unwarranted on the basis of evidence. And in much evolutionary writing, there will be a discussion, a scientific discussion of whatever. But then that discussion verges off into the use of scientism. It involves the dredging up of illustrations or structures. I'm thinking now of such things as common ancestors and intermediate species, which are just mental constructs. I don't have a problem with the evolutionists doing that. I do have a problem with them not distinguishing clearly between science and the scientism. Because particularly laymen sit down, if they read this discussion, they read down through the discussion and really are not able to distinguish between that which is really science and that which is the scientism. And they go away then from the reading with ideas in their mind which to them seem perfectly plausible, but which really are not science. That's why the idea of phylogenetic trees, for example, really are not scientific. They are simply the products of the reasoning of individuals who are trying to provide a non-scientific basis for a view which is often passed off as being science. Now, whether this is always intentionally deceptive or not, I really don't know. I don't know whether evolutionists always go through in their own mind a mental process in which they are distinguishing clearly between that which is science and that which it isn't. I'm sure in some cases they really aren't. It's not intentional deception on their part. It is simply a product of a particular way of thinking. In some cases, I am reasonably certain it is intentional. The individual who is doing the writing or the discussing is, in fact, aware of what has happened, what is happening. They are aware these statements here are in fact science. They can be backed up with laboratory data. At this point, we are simply coming to conclusions about those, that set of factual information, and we are trying to interpret that so that it will be a basis of making evolution plausible. And in this case, it is an intentional deception. Now, if this is a problem for scientists, that is, whether it is intentional or not intentional, imagine the difficulty of a layman who really does not have any access to scientific reasoning and simply accepts everything that is put there in the article or in the book as being science, and therefore has imprinted in his mind the idea that here is a plausible line of thinking which is scientific and which therefore is providing a scientific basis for evidence of the theory of evolution, when in fact that has not happened. It is interesting, well, you can go to Darwin, you can go to most any of the evolutionary writers, and you will find this kind of thing occurring regularly. I think of Stephen Gould, for example, who in some cases makes some very precise, exact, accurate scientific statements. But then these statements will be followed up with conclusions which are not either not legitimate based on those facts, or which are simply constructed, created in an effort to try and use the factual material as the basis of evidence for evolution. Now, this is not a problem that's going to go away. I'm certainly not naive enough to think that we're going to get to the point where all the evolutionary writing is going to make a sharp distinction between this and every time it happens point it out. And by the way, creationists are not altogether without fault in this area either. But I think it's important that there be a line of distinction drawn between that which is actual science and that which is simply an attempt at providing an interpretation which isn't science, but which is scientism, that is holding a view which really is not warranted on the basis of the factual material that's there. If this distinction were maintained clearly, then I think there would be a great deal less difficulty in sorting out some of the arguments we have involving creation as opposed to evolution.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.